Okay, good evening, everybody. Tonight's presentation, for those who've been coming to the ones I've been giving on the world that once was and the previous years as well, is going to be a little bit different. And I must admit that of all the ones that I've prepared, this for me personally was the most emotional. And so what we're going to do tonight is a little bit different. It's going to be less PowerPoint focused, although there will be a PowerPoint. But I really want to see a lot of the primary sources. Sources that I found to be extremely emotional. Sources that really brought me into the Warsaw Ghetto together with Rav Menachem Zemba. And I want to share excerpts with you to bring you back to that emotional place with me as well. So if you don't have your source packet, please have one, because we will be relying on it heavily throughout the class. Tonight we're talking about Rav Menachem Zemba, who is the rabbi or one of the rabbis of the Warsaw Ghetto. Let's take a second just to learn a little bit about his life. So he was born in 1883. He died, as we'll see, in the Warsaw Ghetto in 1943. He was raised by his grandfather. His father died at a very young age. And he was a student of Hasidim. He was his grandfather was a Chassid of the Kutzker Rebbe, a student of the Chidushi Arim. His entire educational foundation was in Chassidus, as we'll see that'll play a little bit in later on. At 18 years old, he marries, and he marries well. He marries someone who's very wealthy. And for the next 20 years, his father-in-law supports Rav Zemba as he's able to just sit and learn. Baruch Hashem, we should all have that. In 1917, unfortunately, his father-in-law passes away. And Rav Zemba is forced to leave the Beis Medrash and to go work. He takes over his father-in-law's business, and for about 18 years there, he is in the business. Now, Rav Zemba was great at many things. One of the things he was not great at was business. By 1935, the business is not doing particularly well, and so he is encouraged to enter more into what we would call the professional rabbinate. He becomes a representative of Praga, not Prague, but Praga, of the Warsaw Rabbinical Council. He was very active in Agudas Yisrael. He was the secretary to the Moetzes Gedolei HaTorah. And, tragically, he was offered two very prominent positions. One was as the chief rabbi of Yerushalayim, and the other was as the Rav of Lublin after Meir Shapiro had passed away. Now, the Rav of Lublin would have kept him into the heart of the Holocaust, but had he taken over the position of the chief rabbi of Yerushalayim, obviously this class would be a little bit different, and Jewish history may have played out a little bit different as well. Needless to say, Rav Menachem Zemba was an enormous Talmud Chacham in ways that we can't even appreciate, which we'll get to in a second. He was one of the last three remaining rabbis of the Warsaw Ghetto, which is why for our Holocaust studies that we're going to do tonight, he is going to be an extremely significant personality. And again, tragically, right before the uprising, he was given the opportunity to escape by the Catholic Church. And we'll see, during the class, two reasons given for why he refused to escape, despite the fact that he was afforded that opportunity. As I mentioned, Rav Zemba was an enormous Talmud Chacham. It shouldn't be lost on us how much of his Torah we are missing, and therefore how much the Jewish people are lacking because his Torah is lacking. So we do have a number of his works. We have a sefer called Zera Avram, which is a response, a dialogue with the son-in-law of the Meshech Chachma. We have another sefer. We have a few that are on Hilchos Shabbos, for example. But the majority of his svarim were completely lost in the liquidation and the bombing of the Warsaw Ghetto. I brought, just to show you a little bit of an example tonight, because you can't really appreciate. And I want you to look at this. Each one of these is 500 pieces of paper. And when stacked up high, which I didn't do because it was blocking people's view, but I want you to look at those 20 reams of paper. And Rav Zemba writes, or it was written about him, that 10,000 of his manuscripts were destroyed with him in the Warsaw Ghetto. I want you to think about how much Torah that means was lost for the Jewish people. Commentary on the Rambam, that's not Mechazesh Lamelech, it's probably something else, but write a sefer on the Rambam, a sefer on the Yerushalmi, Menachem Yerushalayim, four volumes of responsa, a volume of sermons, 10,000 pages, and you have the image there stacked up just to show you how many pieces of paper that is. Each one containing countless words, each one containing chidushim, novel approaches to the Torah, how the body of knowledge that we have to this day could have been changed had we had all of those sheets of paper and many more, because he died at a younger age than he normally would have, right? Imagine how much extra Torah we would have in this world had Rav Zemba not been murdered in the Warsaw Ghetto. And that's why I'm leaving those reams of paper there. I want you, anytime you drift off, just take a look at those. Carrie thought I was crazy when I asked her if she had 20 things of paper. So what do you need it for? I said, don't worry, I'm not going to open it up. I just want to leave it there. And just look at it and appreciate how, first of all, how much that is. It's an enormous amount of halachic work. To be able to write all of that is an enormous amount. To be able to, and then to have lost all of that, is truly what's tragic for the Jewish people. Let's take a second just to talk about the Warsaw Ghetto. So the Warsaw Ghetto, the Germans decreed the establishment of the Warsaw Ghetto on October 12, 1940. Approximately 400,000 people are going to live in the ghetto with 1.3 square miles. According to Yad Vashem, that is 7.2 persons per room, just to give you a little bit of a sense. In 1941, the average Jew in the ghetto lived on 1,125 calories a day, not a lot. And this is a number that I did not believe, so I looked it up numerous times over because I couldn't fathom that staggering number. But it's true. Between July 22nd and September 12, 1942, that's, what, 3 months? Less? The Germans deported or murdered around 300,000 Jews in the Warsaw Ghetto. Of those, just the breakdown, 240,000, they estimate, were brought to where? Primarily Treblinka. And approximately between 50 and 60,000 were either died of starvation or murdered in the street or taken out into a field and killed. 300,000 Jews in a period of 3 months, and even saying that number honestly gives me the chills. It's a staggering, mind-boggling number how 300,000 people can be killed in such a short period of time. Of course, we know that the Warsaw Ghetto was unique in the fact that there was an uprising. There were those who banded together to resist against the Germans. And I want to share with you a few quotes. This one is from Hirsch Wasser in his Melech Nisht, The Destruction and Rebellion of the Jews of Warsaw. He writes, "The will to resist has been sparked among thousands of men and women, elderly people and children, a will which conquers the natural anxiety and the fear of death and hardship. Their will to resist overcame any fear they had of death." Death meant nothing to them at that point. And we'll see that in a few minutes. "The masses have understood that by resisting surrender, they are fighting the enemy in a unique way, hindering his deeds of destruction. The Germans were forced to conquer every single shelter and bunker with full force of arms." And obviously, we're going to talk about this resistance a lot over the next 45 minutes, because if Rav Menachem Zemba is one of the last three remaining rabbis in the Warsaw Ghetto, and if the resistance of the uprising is being plotted, so one of the fundamental things that we have to figure out tonight is, what was his approach to the uprising? What was his take on it? Was he supportive or was he against it? And that's what we're going to talk about as we go through the class tonight. We talk about the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising, July 28, 1942. So right at the beginning of the deportations. Remember, they started on July 22nd. So that week, a group banded together to form, I'm not even going to try to say it in Polish, but it's the Armed Self-Defense, the ZOB. And on January 18th, 1943, they staged their first part of their uprising. They embedded themselves in a group of soldiers that were being taken to the Uschlandplatz, the railway station where they were being taken to Treblinka. Anyone who's ever been to Warsaw knows that there's a big monument that's there. A mirror of that monument is right when you walk into Yad Vashem. I think it's a little bit different, if I recall, but it's parallel in many regards. And they broke out and they started fighting with the Germans. Just to give you a little bit of sense in the map here,
So all the way up top, they used to make these with pointers, but the pointers seem to have gotten lost. Oh, here we go. Yeah. So all the way up top there, number 5, that's the train station. Number 1, which is down here, is the Jewish Council. This is the Warsaw Ghetto. Now, if you go into Google Maps and you Google Warsaw Ghetto, they'll actually give you the outline of where the ghetto once stood. And when you see that, you are shocked to see just how small it is and to think about the number of people that were crammed into that ghetto. Again, and I have copies of this afterwards. You can look at this map more in detail. Okay? Of course, we know that the commander was Mordechai Anilevich. That's how I figured. Anilevich, right, who commanded the fighters on April 19th, 1943, Erev Pesach, the night of Pesach, the liquidation begins. And on the third day of the uprising, which we're going to talk about, because that's the day that Rav Zemba is going to be killed as well, Mordechai Anilevich is killed, and the SS start going door to door, literally raising the entire Warsaw Ghetto. Those are just some of the dates to give us a little bit of an appreciation. So it started in January, from January until Pesach time, also about 3 months, is when the uprising is staged. It forces the Germans. If you read, we'll get to, I don't want to give away all my secrets. Okay. Of course, this is a quote from Mordechai Anislavich, who writes the following. What happened exceeded our boldest dreams. The Germans fled twice from the ghetto. One of our companies held its position for 40 minutes, while the other one lasted upwards of 6 hours. I cannot describe to you the conditions in which the Jews are living. Only a handful will survive. All the rest will succumb sooner or later. Their fate has been sealed. In almost all of the bunkers in which our friends are hiding, one cannot even light a candle at night for lack of air. Goodbye, my friend. Perhaps we will see each other again. The main thing is this. My life's dream has become a reality. I have seen the Jewish defense of the ghetto in all its strength and glory. Now, of course, this story of the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising, anyone who is familiar with Exodus or Mila 18, this is the story of Mila 18. That was the address where the underground, where the uprising was staged, where Anislavich lived. And again, if you go to Poland to this day, this is where it once was. There's a statue, there's a monument on there in memory of Anilevich. Okay. Rav Zemba. So one of the questions that I guess haunts us as we read about his life and about his legacy is, why didn't he escape? So I want to share with you two sources that offer each one their own suggestion. This is from an article that Rabbi Blumenthal spoke about 2 years ago in our great Jewish controversies. One of them was to flee or to stay. Should rabbis run away, flee to Israel, to America, wherever they could, or should they stay with the masses, with their people? So here's a quote from that article. He writes, 2 years later, amidst rampant starvation, deadly disease, and daily mass deportations to death camps, the Archbishop of Warsaw offered Rabbi Menachem Zemba, Rav Samson Stockhammer, and Rav David Shapiro, the three leading rabbis of the Warsaw Ghetto, refuge in his palace, right? This is the Catholic Church that we spoke about. The rabbis discussed the dilemma they suddenly confronted. When asked, Rabbi Shapiro, would this do to the morale of the Jews in the ghetto? He said, I am the youngest among you, and therefore my words are not binding on you. We already know that we cannot help our people, but by staying with them and not abandoning them, we encourage them and strengthen their hopes. And this is the only encouragement we are able to give the last Jews. I simply do not have the strength to abandon these wretched people. Will we hide from the Almighty? The God, the same God who is found there is found here. Rav Shapiro's two colleagues agreed. Rav Zemba declared that there would be no discussion on the issue. Shortly thereafter, Rav Zemba was machine gunned to death. So according to this narrative, why don't the three remaining rabbis run away? Because how could you abandon the people? What would that have done to the morale of the people if you leaders ran away leaving then behind. And of course we know, and you can listen to Rabbi Blumenthal's class on Wayu Torah, but not everyone agreed. There were rabbis that did escape, despite the fact that their people, they had encouraged their people to stay. In fact, there's a really gut-wrenching account of a person who is praying right before during the uprising, right before the Germans are going to come, and it's imminent that the Germans are going to burst through and murder everyone in the bunker. And one of her friends asked her, "What are you doing?" And she said, "I am praying for forgiveness for Rabbi X that chose to flee, leaving us behind. I pray for forgiveness on his behalf." Right? These were not, we're reading words. I just read words on a piece of paper. We can't even fathom the heroism of rabbis that stayed around to be with their people, the gut-wrenching decision those rabbis made who left to save themselves and the Torah that they harbored in their heads, even though they left people behind. These are conversations, again, we're paying lip service to them, but you can't even say them without getting a little bit of a heartache over the tension that is felt on the text itself. There is another reason given, and this is from the Warsaw Ghetto Diaries. We're going to get to the Warsaw Ghetto Diaries in a second, but here he quotes the following. This is a first-hand account of a conversation he had heard with Reb Zemba. He says, "When Reb Nachum Zemba received his passport, he began to consider his options carefully. What he pondered would be the fate of his manuscripts." What would be the fate of his manuscripts? And the paragraph goes on to explain just how much his manuscripts meant to him. Picture of Zemba sitting here, surrounded by 10,000 pieces of paper, notebooks, full of his Torah. Now, if your entire life is writing 10,000 pieces of Torah, you can't just leave it. It's synonymous with you. I'll give you a pathetic example just to showcase you how the value we place on Torah writings. And it's a pathetic example. When I was in yeshiva, you're going to laugh at we say Lahavdil, it's a bad comparison, but hopefully it'll help you understand. When I was in yeshiva, I believe it was either Shana Bet in Israel or right when I had gone to YU, so toward the end of the year, I lost my notebook. All the notes I had taken on the shiurim from that year, I lost them. They must have been cleaning up the Beis Medrash. I must have left it behind. Lost, gone forever. Now, I was upset, right? I'd worked hard that year. I'd written copious notes. And I was talking to one of my rebbeim, and he said, "You know, if the notes really meant something to you, you'd fast right now." I said, "Fast? What are you talking about? I lost a couple pieces of paper." He said, "If the Torah really meant something to you, so you'd fast. You'd be so pained by the fact that you lost Torah that you'll never once again have, that it should pain you. You should fast." Now, I think it was the summertime, so I'm like, I'm not fasting. Days are too long now. But, right, this is real. Person puts his entire life into 10,000 manuscripts, 10,000 papers filled with his novel explanations. It's not so easy to abandon it. And he finishes the writing by saying, as a consequence, "We lost one of the preeminent minds of Polish Jewry. The overwhelming pain still hurts." So there were clearly a number of factors that precluded Rav Zemba from running away from the Warsaw Ghetto, despite the fact that he had the opportunity to. And as we'll learn throughout the night tonight, he makes very good use of his time in the ghetto. He's not simply sitting there waiting for death to arrive at his door, but he is being proactive as a rabbi to comfort and to give hope and to teach Torah and to preserve Torah. And all of that we're going to see over the next couple of minutes. If you open up your source packets, I want to share with you some sources describing just how complicated the Warsaw Ghetto uprising is. Now, we know that history has judged the uprising in what way? Certainly in Zionist history, how have we captured the uprising? How do we record the details of the uprising? They were what? They were heroes. Right? In fact, it's not just Yom HaShoah, but it's Yom HaShoah the Hagvura, right? We celebrate those who chose to fight back and to resist the German authorities. Okay? We have, perhaps rightfully so, perhaps not, we'll see, right? We have made the uprising into heroes. It's not so simple, though. And I want to share with you some of the tension that was felt amongst the rabbis of the time. Now, not all of this is directly from Rav Zemba, but it's all surrounding the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising. It's rabbis writing about the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising. And although it's in Hebrew, I'm going to read it a few paragraphs to you because it is critically important to understanding just how complicated the discussion was. So if you look up page number one. Now, I'll teach you a little trick. I learned this week. Should I share with you tricks of the trade? Apparently, someone told me, and it works, Google Translate now, right? You all have apps on your phone. If not, your grandchildren do, okay? Google Translate, you can take a picture of this page right now and rub your finger over it, and Google will translate this page for you. Now, it's not a perfect translation because it obviously doesn't understand Talmudic terms, etc. But it'll get you 90% of the way there. So if you go home and you say, oh, I really wanted to remember what Moskowitz was talking about, call your grandchild, ask them about Google Translate, take a picture, bada bing, bada boom. Okay? You don't need to have a brain anymore. Google does it for you, okay? But thank God we have a brain here tonight, and let's learn a little bit. So it's on the very first page. And again, we're not going to read a lot, but what we're going to read, I think, is very important. Look at the arrow on page number one. This is from a source of Yehoshua Moshe Aronson, who is a rabbi in a very small congregation. He was sent to the Konan labor camp, and I believe he survived, moved to Israel, but he kept his journal of the annihilation of the Jews in his camp. And he's writing about the Warsaw Ghetto. He writes here the following. Anshei ha'emuna, those people of faith, yatzu mitoch hanachat yesod besisit. They lived by one, what's the word I'm looking for? One phrase, one mantra. Thank you. Netzach Yisrael lo yishaker. That the Jewish people will always survive. They will never be wiped out. Am Yisrael Yisrod. That the Jewish people will survive. Hatzlachat ha-Germanim, the victory of the Germans. Tegadel kechol she-tegadel. Yeah, they'll have their moment. They'll have an enormous amount of success. Zviyoseim echayotot yatzmu kechol she-yatzmu. Their animal horrors, their animalistic behavior will be what it'll be. However, ein bahem mesek kanfei netzach. But it won't be for eternity. Ma'asehem regaim ubeli chalof. Their actions are temporary. Bimukdam o bimukhar yitapech ha-gilgal vehem yiplu matamata. Sooner or later, tides are going to turn and they will go down. This is what the Gemara says. Gezeira avida debatla. Any gezeira is ultimately going to be mevatel. It's only ultimately going to be undone. Kol gezeira al ami yudi. Any decree against the Jewish people, no matter how hard or difficult it is, sofa shetit batel. Eventually, it's going to be undone. In other words, even though the Germans are having their way with us right now, it is temporary and it is not everlasting. Go to the next arrow, couple lines down. Anche Hamari, Yachmei Hahitnagdut, right? The resistance fighters. Lo yirkiru b'chazonam al chofei atid. They're not worrying about the future. Hahove hamar mimavet amad l'negin p'nehem. The only thing they see is imminent death in front of their face. And therefore, what are they choosing? He says, they choose to die at a second Masada. In other words, we're not going to let the Germans kill us. We're going to kill ourselves first. We'd rather die as heroes than go like sheep to the slaughter. Now, turn the page. He's going to give his opinion on the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising. He says, again, top of the page where I have the bracket. Begetto Varsha, shardu ke 50 elef nefesh. There remained 50,000 people. Kulam hushmadu al yedei haftzatzot masibiot mina avir. They all died by bombs from the sky. Shevchuat Agito Kulo Liir Charevot, which decimated the ghetto, reduced it to nothing. Kinakamal Amerit, and what was that all for? Revenge over the uprising. Now he asked, Yitachein, these are haunting words, Kilulei Hamerit, it might be, had the Jewish people not resisted, had they not revolted, Hayachelak Nichba Nitzal Vishored, maybe some of the Jews would have survived. Haim Yesh Zchut Musarit Lachriz Al Hamered, did they have the right to revolt against the Germans, knowing that it would cause the death of all 50,000 Jews? That's amazing. He says, Nachon Hu, you're right. Kigam Lulei HaMered, without the revolt, Hayaruvam Shel Yudivar Shemotzim Es Mitasam, big ghettos. You're right. Even without the revolt, many would have died. But what does he say? Ruvam Amarnu, Avalo Kulam. Many of them would died, not all of them. And he says, we the leaders, Roe Yisrael, we the shepherds of Israel, we should have done a better job of steering these young, zealous people in a direction that would be productive and not catastrophic. He says, now maybe you'll tell me, anyone who's ever learned Masechet Sanhedrin, very famous case of Baba Machteret, someone comes in a tunnel to kill you, you're allowed to kill them first, right? I believe in Florida we call it stand your ground, right? That's the contemporary equivalent to it, okay? So maybe you'll say that if the Germans are going to kill you, you have the right to kill them first. He says that might be the case. But maybe you would have saved more Jews had you spent your time trying to evade and to flee and to run away. And so therefore he says, Af im naniach ki amatzlichem larog elef nazi, maybe you killed thousands of Nazis, but haitatzricha lihisha'el hasheila, the question remains, be'eza machir, which means, at what price? It's crazy comment. He says there were 50,000 Jews in Warsaw. 49,050 would have been killed, let's say. What gave you the right to condemn the other 50 to death? Don't we have a concept, he says it right here, that kol ha, anyone who saves nefesh achat mi Yisrael, that if you save one Jew, you've saved an entire world. And therefore also, if you've killed one Jew unnecessarily, he says you've destroyed an entire world. Wow. Wow. I saw this, it blew my mind. Totally different take on the uprising. And then, well, he doesn't end there. Because it takes broad shoulders to make a statement about, right, we have a rule. You never judge people during the Holocaust. That's just a rule. It's a good rule to live by. You can't judge. You weren't there. You don't understand the circumstances. You don't know what it was like to see death all around you, to hate these people more than you hate. You can't even understand it. So he says in the end that although I said this, you can't judge those in the Warsaw Ghetto. He says, Mivli l'nasot l'ashime kedoshei ha-shoah. Now he calls them kedoshim. He says, we can never judge them. They did the best that they can. He says, we have the hindsight, but in hindsight it was clear that they did the wrong thing. That's how he ends it. He says, Hayom karbaim shana achar ha-churban, 40 years later, Ole umizdakaret b'mishna zohar gedolot, right, we understand more clearly that perhaps the uprising was a mistake. Now I share this with you, obviously we're talking about Rav Nachum Zemba tonight, and we will, I promise. But I share this with you because when we get to Rav Zemba's perspective, you can't understand in a vacuum. You have to realize that there were those that felt that the uprising was a mistake. That there were those that felt that it killed people, in it, as opposed to necessarily saving people. If you turn the page to page 3, I'll share with you the flip side. Page 3 and 4 are a little bit the same, but 4 is a little shorter. So page 3, I'll just tell you what it is. It's from Yechiel Yaakov Weinberg. Yechiel Yaakov Weinberg has an extremely tragic life. He ultimately escapes the Holocaust. He ends up in Switzerland. Very prominent rabbi, but in the aftermath of the Holocaust, loses so much of his family, loses so much of his life, he never fully recaptures his grandeur. If you want to read a book about him, Dr. Mark Shapiro has really the be-all and end-all book on Rav Yechiel Yaakov Weinberg. It's tremendous. I remember I was in high school, I read it in one Shabbos. I couldn't put it down. It's really fantastic. So you should read his book. But Rav Yaakov Weinberg and Rav Oshri basically say the same thing, but Rav Oshri is a little more condensed. So let's go to page number 4. And Rav Oshri says the following. He's having a halachic discussion about this very topic, whether you should stay to fight the Germans or whether you should focus on running away. And he says all the way on the bottom of page 4, he quotes a Minchas Chinuch, which we're not going to get into right now, but he says, it's clear from studying the Minchas Chinuch, she'amilchama hazot, that this war with the Germans, she'hagermanim ha'arurim, tzatzei Amalek, that these Germans are the descendants of Amalek, yimach shemo, hichrizu al yudim la'avdam u'la'ashmidam, they decreed against the Jews to kill them, bivadai, certainly, he says, she'achiv, it's an obligation, v'hamitzvah, and it's a mitzvah. Mutalim al Yudim lashiv milchama she'ara ulashiv lahem gmulam, pay them back. Vilasot lahem kasher heim zomemim aleinu, do unto them as they wanted to do to you. Umitzvah, think about that word. It is a mitzvah. Lirdof otam be'af, it's a mitzvah to chase after them with anger. Ulashmidam mitachat shmei Hashem, and to wipe them out of this face of this earth. And Rav Yechiel Yaakov Weinberg uses slightly more gentle terms, but very similar. So you have both sides of the coin, and I tried to show you that this was a very dynamic conversation, both at the time and afterwards, in rabbinic literature. What about Rav Menachem Zemba? So the primary source that I'm going to share with you tonight is from the Warsaw Ghetto Diaries, Dr. Hillel Seidman. Dr. Hillel Seidman was a member, as an archivist in the Warsaw Kehila. He was a researcher, author, devoted Jew, and he kept a faithful account of Warsaw's last days. Now, if you go online and try to purchase this, which I did, the cheapest copy you will be able to find is on ABE Books for $843. Okay, now, thankfully, we have someone in the community that bought it at Eichler's 10 years ago for $21. And I was able to ask him to borrow the copy. Now, I don't know if you can find a copy, but if you can, you must. That's how important this book is. In fact, I don't know how much I should divulge, but I've been reading over the last number of nights. Needless to say, I say this unabashedly, I've been waking up with nightmares. It is such a vivid description of life in the Warsaw Ghetto, death in the Warsaw Ghetto, religious life in the Warsaw Ghetto. I have a copy I'm happy to send to anyone. If you read nothing else but the report that they received from someone who escaped from Treblinka and came back to the ghetto and told people that they weren't being sent to some paradise or some, you know, utopian labor camp, but they were being sent to Treblinka. And the first time that people in Warsaw heard about this, you won't sleep that night. I promise you will not sleep that night. That is how shocking it was to read, even for people that grew up with the Holocaust and have been hearing about it their entire lives. What I want to share with you tonight is a little bit about Rav Menachem Zemba and his perspective on the uprising. So if you look at page number 5, and everything else we're going to read tonight is in English, thankfully, but he says the following. Rav Menachem Zemba declares, again, they just found out that there's another deportation that's looming and everyone wants to know what to do. So Rav Menachem Zemba declares, at least we should not have gone voluntary to the Umschlagplatz, right? We shouldn't have just gone voluntarily to the trains. We have tried to resist, but we fooled ourselves with wishful thinking.
A people renowned for wisdom and intelligence lost all good sense. In other words, we should have known better. Right? What does Rabbi Soloveitchik say is the real miracle of the Purim story? Anyone remember? No, he says the real miracle of the Purim story is for the first time in history, when one of our enemies told us they were going to kill us, we actually believed him. That's what Zemba is saying here. What fools! We should have known better by now. That when someone says they're going to kill us, they're going to kill us. He says, a people renowned for wisdom lost all good sense. Throughout, we relied on perhaps, possibly, maybe. Our enemies spoke continually about our powerful brothers abroad, who wielded so much influence around the world. Why didn't they remember us? Their brothers and sisters threatened with extinction. So we dared to believe and hope that eventually rescue would arrive. If not for that expectation, we might have behaved perhaps differently. In other words, he's lamenting the fact that they didn't resist sooner. Don't forget, if 300,000 people are deported and killed in a 3-month period, imagine had the resistance started beforehand or in a more organized attempt beforehand when they were more numerous in numbers, right? 300, 400,000 people revolting is much different than 50,000 people revolting. Power in numbers. He says we made the cardinal error of considering our enemies as stupid fools and thinking we might be too clever for them. Cleverness or sharpness is not the same as effective as wisdom. It didn't work for Korach, and it hasn't worked for us. Perhaps we should have realized from the outset that the Russia really did intend to destroy everything. From the beginning, we should have used every opportunity and tactic to alert the conscience of the world. All we can do now is resist to the best of our abilities. We may not surrender ourselves voluntarily into enemy hands. Go to page 6. He quotes this conversation he has about a Rambam, and eventually on the bottom of the page, left-hand side, eventually Rav Zemba spoke again with great deliberation. This is probably one of the most famous quotes that you'll see about Rav Menachem Zemba. He says there are different ways to Kiddush Hashem, different ways to sanctify God's name. If Jews were now being forced to forsake their religion and they could save their lives by baptizing themselves, as during Spain and the Crusades, then our death alone can constitute a Kiddush Hashem. Notice throughout history, they wanted us to convert, and we died al Kiddush Hashem. In fact, according to the Rambam, even if a Jew is killed for not denying his Jewishness, that too is considered Kiddush Hashem. But today, the only way to sanctify his name is armed resistance. Zemba says, we have to Kiddush Hashem for us. Sanctifying God's name means not just sitting there, but we have to fight back. Now it happens to be that despite this source, not every historian has the same take on Zemba's words, but this is 98% how it is interpreted to be understood. So that's the quote you have here today. The only way to sanctify his name is armed resistance. Okay, and again, here you have the Boca Raton Synagogue group, led by Rabbi Gober 2 summers ago, they went to Poland. This is that group, their group, at the Warsaw Uprising Monument in Warsaw. Okay, that's physical resistance for a second. What about spiritual resistance? What was Rav Zemba doing during the uprising, during the ghetto, to maintain Torah? So if you look on pages, I gave you the page numbers, you can look at it afterwards, but learning Torah, page number 7. I know, I also find it confusing when it's back in front. All right, I tried to save some paper. No. Okay, it says 112, 113, page number 7. It says, Rav Menachem Zemba is meanwhile writing his Chidushei Torah. That is wild, right? Everything going on around, and Rav Zemba's sitting there, and he's writing his Chidushim. As he explains to me, if not for your Torah, which is my pleasure, Lulei Sarascha Shashua, Azovadati Bani, we know that from a famous Rosh Shlomo Karlbach song. But it was a pasuk in Tehillim first. He shows me a responsa from the Minchas Chinuch, which he headed with the words, "Be'ezra Hashem Yisbarach, during the days of wrath and destruction, will you destroy the remnants of Israel? Second day of Slichos, to your judgment we stand today, for we are all your servants." That's how he headed. That's the headline that he has on the piece of paper. Then he turns to his son-in-law, Reb Ber of Askara, to argue in learning.
after a discussion, dot, dot, dot. Later I hear him discuss the Sfas Emes, and he repeats the previous Ger Rebbe's explanation on the divine promise to redeem the Jews from Sivlos Mitzrayim, the tortures of Mitzrayim. Listen to this, such a great word. He says Sivlos can also mean, right, doesn't just mean the tortures, he says it also means acceptance or resignation. We ask Hashem not just to save us from the tortures of the Holocaust, but we ask Hashem that we never accept the situation that we're in, that we never become resigned to our own fate, but we ask Hashem that we're always prepared to fight back and to try to change the status quo. What an amazing Dvar Torah, right? That Hashem saves us misiblos misraim, not just from hardship, but Hashem saves us from accepting hardship. That as a Jew, we should never just accept hardship. Rabbi Sachs, I'll just tell you parenthetically, in his siddur, so he has, I must have a meeting at 8:30 or something that my computer just beeped for. Anyways, Rabbi Sachs has an amazing idea. We say at the end of benching, Nara Yisi v'gam zakanti, I was right young, I'm old, v'lo ra'isi tzadik nezav, I never saw an older person, a righteous person forsaken. So obviously that's not the case. You look throughout history and we have seen it. So he quotes from Megillas Esther, where he says, V'lo ra'isi means, the word ro'eh in this context means that I never saw and accepted it. I never saw a righteous person being mistreated and just sat on the sidelines and accepted it for what it is. But V'lo ra'isi means that I never saw it and didn't do anything about it. Every time I saw injustice in the world, I got up and I did something about it. That's how Rabbi Sachs explains V'lo ra'isi tzadik nezav, a really beautiful interpretation. But this is the Torah. This is the Torah that Rav Zemba is sharing in the Holocaust. Page number 8. Similarly, which we'll skip over for now, but again, you can read it on your own. A beautiful idea about Erevin and Atilas Yadayim. Page number 9. This is wild. It's Erev Rosh Hashanah. Now, think about Rosh Hashanah. You're in the ghetto. It's Erev Rosh Hashanah. It's 1942 at this point, okay? You know what's happening. By September, remember we said 300,000 Jews had already been deported or killed. Can you imagine what Rosh Hashanah was like that year in the Warsaw Ghetto? And yet, what does Rav Zemba do? Rav Zemba goes over to everyone and wishes them a good year. Have a good year. When he meets Rav Zemba, second paragraph, he says, Rav Zemba quotes the Gemara, even when the blade of a sharp sword rests against one's neck, one must still not despair from divine mercy. This is still hope. There is still hope. A good year. Besides, I can prove that this year will be an improvement on the last. Simple, Rav Zemba says. There no longer remains 3.5 million Jews in Poland to be tormented and murdered. So this year cannot possibly be as bad as the last. Let us hope it will be a better year. That's crazy. I mean, again, you read these words, you can't even fathom to say that. Yet when I repeated these comforting words to Dr. Shipper, he refused to accept it. This is not true, he protested. The remnants are still in mortal danger. Terrible catastrophes are still possible. But I remain confident that those who have survived until now will live until the end. What else have they carried out? Why else have they carried out all these selections? And of course we know that's tragically not. But can you imagine on Rosh Hashanah, the emuna, the faith, to be able to go over to someone and say, a good year should be a good year. Next year is going to be a little bit better than last year. The emuna, the faith that was involved is simply mind-boggling. Turn to page 10. Sukkot 1942. We've gone from Rosh Hashanah to Sukkot. Obviously, what don't they have? Anything. They don't have a Sukkot. They don't have a lulav and esrog. Listen to the arrow. I remember of Sukkot 1942. Under extreme danger, a Menachem broke open the roof of his apartment to construct a primitive sukkah. True, it was a tiny sukkah, but thousands of people passed through. Thousands of people yearning in the darkest times of our history. They just wanted to fulfill a mitzvah. True, it was only a tiny, right? On Erev Sukkot, I received 3 esrogim from Switzerland. Naturally, I brought them all straight to Rav Menachem Zemba. Rav Menachem displayed great delight with his esrog, and he was joined for the tefilos by 2 remaining Rabbanim, Rabbi Stockhomer and Rabbi Shapiro, we learned about earlier. Immediately, the news spread.
Hundreds of Hasidim and Yeshiva Bachrim crawled through attics, tunnels, and cellars to perform the precious mitzvah. We always talk about physical resistance, but we can never talk about the physical resistance without also talking about the spiritual resistance. Those who defied, honestly defied logic, to maintain any bit of Judaism that they could. And lastly, on page number 11, you have a story. We don't have to read inside, but there were makeshift yeshivas that were held in the bunkers. Right? Think about it. They were holed up in the bunkers. And so what did they do? They learned Torah. Now listen to what he says here. The third line from the end of... almost to the end, about four lines off from the end of that paragraph. He says, outside, the first one lied, outside. Outside, panic reigned. No one knew what the unnatural lulls signified. Everybody feared what the morrow would bring. The Gedolei Torah of Nachum Zemba and his Talmidim ignored this bitter reality to soar to the spiritual heights of Torah and Yirah Shamayim. Right? What were they doing in the bunkers? Bombs, guns. He describes here that every time they heard a gunshot, they knew exactly what that meant. And yet Rav Zemba sitting there describes how he used to go from bunker to bunker on Mila Street and this street and that street. He would climb at night from one house to the next. Why? Because he wanted to give the students chizuk. He wanted to make sure that the Torah sustained itself. This is what he was doing in the Warsaw Ghetto. It's an amazing testimony to who he was, to what his values were, to how much he valued the preserving and the teaching of Torah. And quite honestly, and I speak personally, I don't project it on anyone else, it is an enormous mechayiv. Right? We who live in comfort, in relative tranquility, in religious autonomy, and how we spend our time and how they spent their time, it's really, words can't even do justice to it. I'll share three more examples of spiritual resistance. Turn to page 12. This is from a different work called The Unconquerable Spirit. And here he writes two examples. Okay, three examples. We'll only read two of them. It's a little smaller. Left-hand side. This one, I read it to Aria last night. When I finished reading, she was crying. So hopefully I'll get through it. He says, some heart-rending scenes took place at the rabbi's apartment, talking about Rabbi Zemba. One day, and I don't have this book, a friend of mine who has it scanned it, and that's why it looks the way it does. I won't say who did it. Okay? One day, a young couple appeared, both of them in tears. The husband wanted to give his wife a divorce. No, they were not unhappy together. The problem was something else. The husband had an opportunity to smuggle himself out of the ghetto into the Aryan sector, and naturally had wanted to take his wife with him. But the young woman was afraid that her pronounced Jewish features would give them both away. Besides, her parents were in the ghetto, and she didn't want to abandon them to almost certain death. But she didn't want her husband to lose the chance to escape because of her. At first, her husband had refused to leave. Finally, however, he had acceded to her tearful pleas that he save himself, but only under the condition that they first go to the rabbi and obtain a divorce. If they were to be separated, he pointed out to his shocked wife, and he were killed, she probably would have no way of establishing beyond all doubt that he was not, in fact, alive somewhere. In that case, she would remain a guna, neither wife nor widow, unable to rebuild her life in a new marriage. By divorcing her before he left the ghetto, her husband wanted to protect her from the tragic fate. If she would not consent to the divorce, he would not leave her. Rabbi Zemba understood only too well what he had to do, and so with tears streaming down his cheeks, he wrote out the bill of divorcement. Unbelievable. But this is the decisions that couples needed to make to save him, to divorce her in case he died and she survived. That's all he cared about, was that his wife would be able to rebuild her life. It's unbelievable. Next one, a little less gut-wrenching, but also pretty amazing. A young man accompanied by his aged mother came to Rav Zemba with a strange request. He wanted the rabbi to persuade his mother to undergo baptism. The young man had been assigned to a labor detail outside the ghetto. There he had met a Polish Gentile who had offered to hide him and his mother in his home. There's only one problem. Gentile knew that it was forbidden to harbor Jews. So she goes to this guy and she says, I'll harbor you, but on one condition, you have to convert to Christianity.
So this guy is bringing his mother to Rav Zemba so that Rav Zemba will encourage the mother to baptize. End of the paragraph. Rav Zemba said to her, "Your mother says she wants to remain alive only if she can live as a Jewess. Do you really expect me then to tell her to end her days as a Gentile?" Right? It's better to die a Jew than to die as a Gentile. Okay, this is what we talk about. We talk about the spiritual resistance, how they defied literally logic with their unimaginable faith and perseverance to maintain their Judaism, to maintain their emunah, to ask shailas, to ask questions of Rav Zemba. April 20th, drawing closer, the day of the liquidation, a couple of weeks, 3 weeks before Pesach, and what do? They make a day of fasting. Right? They declare Rosh Chodesh Nisan as a day of fast. Turn to page 13. Okay? Again, davening to Hashem. Rav Zemba, it describes there, gives a stirring. Oh, sorry. Rav Zemba describes, he gives a stirring drasha, which you have there. We don't have to read inside, but on my arrow, on page number 13, you have the drasha that he gave. And he writes here, this is from his nephew who's writing this. So he says, "I had heard my uncle preach many times before, but never had I heard him deliver such a soul-stirring appeal to hearts and minds as he did on that day." And again, you can read it on your own. Describes that in the lead up to Pesach, Rav Zemba was insistent that they have matzah. They had a whole factory, he describes, of those who were in charge of ensuring that everyone had what they would need for Pesach. The day of liquidation is coming. And this is what they're worried about. They want to make Pesach for everyone. Okay? Now, before we read the end of the story, I just want to watch the following clip.
Entire style portion was completely wrecked. But the flames were so concentrated around the whole ghetto that had illuminated the whole city. The next week, the same week, was Palm Sunday. I couldn't be anymore with my parents in the hiding. I walked out on the Palm Sunday and I went to Platz Kaczynski, where there was a church, a very old church, and I felt that my safest place was in the church. I went to that church and I attended the Mass and the priest spoke. Not a word was mentioned that across the street people are fighting, dying by the hundreds in fire. I was just like a good Christian listening to the whole sermon. Then it is traditional in Poland when after the services the priest comes out in front of the church and he greets the people. Probably is practiced in every country the same way, but in Poland it is a traditional thing. And he greeted all the Poles. And across the street was a carousel with a playground. And the music was playing. And the carousel was, the people took the children on the carousel, beautifully dressed, Sunday, Palm Sunday. Music was playing and I was standing in that group watching the other side of the block of that burning ghetto. From time to time we heard screaming, "Look, look, people are jumping from the roofs." Others would make remarks, "Jews are frying." That's just a free translation from Polish. But I never heard any sympathy voices. Maybe there were people who looked in a different way, but I never heard. And it was very heartbreaking for me that here I'm helpless, I can do nothing. And And I gotta see and watch, and I cannot even protest. I cannot even show my anger. Sometimes I felt that I have to do something physically, even have to pay with my life, and start screaming, but I didn't do it. I didn't scream. I didn't do anything. I just was hurt. But that scene will probably remain with me all my life.
I showed that to you to get us into the mindset a little bit of what we're about to read. That's a Christian who lived in Warsaw at the time, describing what he's sitting across the street from the ghetto as it's being burned to the ground, and the imagery is just stark. That on one side of the street, Jews are jumping from the rooftop. The other side of the street, there are little kids on carousels and they're giving out candy. And he says no one even blinks an eye. Oh, there's a Jew just jumped off the roof, but no one even stops to protest, to wonder, to be sad, to mourn. Okay? Now you have here two pictures. That's a picture of the liquidation of the ghetto, and that's what the ghetto looks like after the Germans got through with it. It's just an insane picture. But let's read a little bit. This is Pesach in Warsaw. We are on the bottom of page 13. And I'm going to read almost straight now, because it'll do a better job than anything I could do. Okay, on the third day, on the day before the first Seder, the suspense broke. Polish policemen spread a rumor that the Polish police had received orders from the Germans to take up stations at the ghetto walls at midnight. Everybody understood what that meant. The people vanished from the streets into their homes, gathering their last possessions for the move to the hideouts. Members of the resistance prepared themselves, page 14. And by midnight, everyone is ready. Again, you can read this on your own. They vowed to fight themselves, not to go to their deaths without a fight. Bottom of page 14, where it says 84, on the bottom left-hand side. During the early hours of Passover Eve, this is Pesach night, the first Nazi detachment marched into the ghetto. They were met by a hail of gunfire from rooftops and hideouts. Momentarily caught off balance, they withdrew to regroup their forces. Thus began the Battle of the Warsaw Ghetto. As one of the central figures of the ghetto, Rabbi Zemba had been the object of constant surveillance from the Germans. As a consequence, he had not been able to participate directly in the preparations for the battle. But his chief lieutenant, and Rav Zemba is in shelter. Go to page 15. And again, you're welcome to take these with you on your own and read them in their entirety. In the middle of the page, where the paragraph starts, night fell. Night fell. So this is Pesach. The Passover holiday had begun. The rabbi glanced at his watch and asked everyone in the attic, and asked whether everyone in the attic had with him his personal portion of matzahs required for the observance of the Seder. Already weeks before, he had prepared for himself matzahs small enough to keep in his coat pocket at all times, and had urged everyone else to do likewise. "We don't know where we will be when Pesach comes," he had said, "but if we keep some matzahs with us wherever we go, we will at least be able to observe this mitzvah of eating matzah on the Pesach night no matter where we are." That's what he's thinking about. He wants to make sure that they fulfill the mitzvah of Pesach. At long last, there was a lull in the shooting outside. The rabbi led us down the steps into his apartment to celebrate the Seder. He recited the Haggadah with unusual devotion, frequently interspersing the traditional text with profound, erudite comments of his own. Describes in the next paragraph, during the early hours of the morning, the Nazis, now supported with additional troops, come, battling, going door to door. They're sending airplanes to shower the ghetto with bombs, and within minutes, wide areas of the ghettos are in flames. You just look at the pictures and it gives you a little bit of an insight. Right-hand side. On Saturday morning, the third day of Chol Moed, third intermediate day of Pesach, the buildings on either side of the street caught fire. When the flames began to lick at our attic, panic broke out.
some terrified at the thought of being suffocated by smoke or trapped by the fast-spreading fire, wanted to leave. But Rabbi Zemba ordered them not to go. "Try to put out the flames," he commanded, and took the lead himself, carrying buckets of water. The people listened to the rabbi and did not leave the hideout. But by noon, the attic was filled with smoke, and the flames had reached the steps leading to the attic. "Now at last, Rabbi Zemba led us out of the shelter. But where could we go? We knew that in the streets outside, the SS men were waiting to kill Jews as they emerged from their burning homes. We went down into the basement of the house, but we knew that we would not be able to stay there long. We therefore decided during the next brief lull in the firing to make for the building across the street where Rebbeir, the rabbi of Wall, had been hiding out." When the firing seemed to have abated for a few moments, Rabbi Zemba's daughter, Rebbetzin Rosa Wiedenfeld, looked out of the basement window. Apparently, not aware that there were SS men in front of the house, she told us to follow her out of the basement and into the adjacent building. She led the way. We saw her signaling to us with her hand. Tragically, we mistook her signal to mean that it was safe for us to proceed. And so we went after her, led by Rabbi Zemba, who was holding his 5-year-old grandson, Yankala Bear, by the hand. Suddenly, we heard gunfire, followed by wild screams coming from the ruins of Nalweki 39. For a split second, we did not realize what was happening. Rabbi Zemba, only a few steps ahead of us, had fallen to the ground. But we were not able to stop. The steady gunfire drove us back into the basement we had left only the moments before. Until late afternoon, we did not know what had happened to Rabbi Zemba. We hoped against hope that he had merely tripped and fallen and somehow managed to escape. After nightfall, we cautiously ventured outside to see whether there was any trace of the rabbi. We did not have to search for long. His lifeless body lay on the pavement in front of the building. Somehow, the news of the rabbi's death spread from hideout to hideout. Unmindful of the danger, dozens of his friends and admirers crept out of their shelter to pay their last respects to their teacher. Several Torah scholars, constituting themselves as an ad hoc court of religious law, decided that Rabbi Zemba's remains should be placed into a temporary grave in the courtyard. As soon as conditions permitted, the scholars ruled, he should be reinterred in the Jewish cemetery. Late that night, by the eerie light of flames veiled in the clouds of smoke, we buried Rabbi Menachem Zemba. Among those present at the scene were two of his daughters, one of his son-in-law, Rebbeir, and his youngest son, Rav Aaron Naftali Zemba, who recited the mourner's Kaddish. Thus ended the life of Rav Menachem Zemba, who by his own great example taught his disciples how to live, and if need be, to die with the dignity befitting upright, proud Jews. That is the story of Rav Menachem Zemba. I want to learn, to finish up tonight, a piece of his Torah. We've learned a little bit of it in English, but as we said, this course isn't just learning about the people, but it's bringing their Torah back to life. It's understanding the Torah that they lived for and were willing to die for. And so I found a short Dvar Torah, which I think resonates, certainly after what we read. The Gemara says, the Pasuk says, that Esav sone es Yaakov, that Esav hates Yaakov. And Rashi quotes, Amar of Shimon halachahi, biyadua she'esav sone liyaakov. It's a halacha. It's law that Esav hates Yaakov. Ask Rav Zemba, Ma'inyan hag musag halacha lakan. What does it mean that's a halacha, that Esav hates Yaakov? Open up a Shulchan Aruch. Tell me, where in the Shulchan Aruch does it say that Esav has to hate Yaakov? And he says the following Dvar Torah. He says, there are many people who try to find reasons for anti-Semitism. Try to find reasons. Why do they hate us? They hate us because we're capitalists. They hate us because we're socialists. They hate us because we, right? LeBron James. They hate us because we love money. They hate us because we... They hate us for everything. Everyone tries to find a reason for why anti-Semitism. We didn't live in Israel. We do live in Israel. There's always going to be a reason for anti-Semitism. He says, right? He even says here, some people because we're capitalists. Some people because we're socialists. Some people because we're too smart. Some people because we're too stupid. Right? Everyone hates us for a different reason. But what does Rav Shimon teach us? He says, Halacha hi biyadua she'esav sona liyakov. Sinato shel Esav liYaakov,
Esav's hatred of Yaakov. You want to know why anti-Semitism exists? It's a halacha. L'lo koltam v'nimug. It's what it is. It's the way the world was created. It's a chok. Same way we don't understand Parah Aduma, but it exists. And we don't understand Kashrus, he says, because it exists. You can try to find reasons for anti-Semitism. You can try to figure out why Haman wanted to destroy us, and why Paro wanted to destroy us, and why Hitler wanted to destroy us, and Stalin wanted to destroy us, right? We can go every generation. You pick a century. I'll pick you the name. And each name is going to be a different one, right? Shakespeare, because of money. This guy, because of social. Everyone has a different reason. But you know what Rav Zemba said? The reason why? It's a halacha psuka. Hashem created the world. This is anti-Semitism. It's built into the very fabric of the world that we live in, that our enemies are going to hate us. That's the Dvar Torah from Rav Menachem Zemba, reading into this Rashi of Halacha hi she'esav sone liyako. That's the class. I hoped, I tried tonight to bring some of his biography to life a little bit, to bring some of his Torah to life a little bit, and to bring the Warsaw Ghetto, the circumstances that he was living in, to life a little bit, so that we can appreciate just how unique of an individual he is. Now that we've understood a little bit more of who he is, go back tonight, read some of the spiritual resistance that he exhibited during the Holocaust, and think about how amazing it is that in the darkest depths ever known to humanity, they were thinking about Sukkot. They were thinking about having matzah for Pesach. They were thinking about making sure that your spouse was taken care of, even if you were no longer around. That's what was on their mind. They were devoted to the Torah Hashem. They were so devoted with emuna, with faith, and to the emunas chachamim. That's really the legacy of Rav Menachem.